From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Filmmaker Errol Morris spent much of his documentary career pulling deeply, often strangely, human tales out of the fringes of American society. Starting with Gates of Heaven in 1978, he proceeded to bring us face to face with the paraplegic founder of a pet cemetery, an exuberant robot builder, a mole rat researcher, and a man wrongly convicted of murder. With his viewers, he has followed his fascination with the bizarre and impassioned into compelling, often disturbing corners of the human soul. Now, Morris has turned his lens on big game, former U.S. Secretary of Defense and architect of the Vietnam War, Robert McNamara. Morris creates a moving study of one of the 20th century's most controversial figures with trademark quirkiness and some controversial tools. Tonight on Point, Errol Morris on McNamara and Errol Morris. Has Errol Morris made your screen, challenged your view of the world of your fellow Americans? How much creative leeway do you want to give a film documentarian to get at something like truth? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Errol Morris, producer and director of 11 groundbreaking documentary films, including Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, The Thin Blue Line, and now The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara. Good evening and welcome, Errol Morris.
Thank you very much for having me. Here, I'm curious about these controversial tools that you mentioned.
Well, I want you to help me understand that, because part of what I understand about your work is that you've used recreations of situations in your documentaries. And I want to come to that. I'm not sure there was so much of that in McNamara, but maybe you can lay out for us whether there was or not. This idea of recreations as part of a documentary experience is something I hope we can explore tonight. But before we get there, if you'd be kind enough, I wish you'd give us a sense of how you moved along the kind of ladder of American life from swamp dwellers and mole rat researchers and pet cemetery founders to Robert McNamara. How did you get your hooks in to this guy?
Well, I wish I could claim there's some logic to the path that I followed. I'm not at all sure that there is beyond the fact that all of these stories in some way has interested me. In particular, the story of Robert S. McNamara, someone who I demonstrated against many, many years ago as a young student.
Over Vietnam.
And whose books, his recent books, I read with great interest. Three of them, in retrospect, Argument Without End, and most recently, Wilson's Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Was never sure he would agree to an interview, kept putting it off, finally called him, and to my surprise, he agreed.
When you think of Robert McNamara as someone who's going to agree to an interview with David Frost or Tom Brokaw, I don't know, someone like that, did he understand who you were, Errol Morris? Did he understand the kind of work that you do, the kind of way that you wriggle down into the heart of things, maybe the dark heart of things sometimes?
Wait a second. Who am I?
Well, yeah, that's a big one. But did he even have a sense at all?
My hunch is that he saw me as part of a book tour. He had just been traveling around the country talking about his most recent book. This was 2001, Wilson's Ghost. I called him and he agreed to come to Cambridge, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where I live, for an interview. He called me just a couple of days before the interview and said, you know, I've been thinking about this. I suspect he'd been talking to people.
He'd begun to use Google or use his network to figure out a little more about Errol Morris's work.
I've been talking to people, and I can't think of any reason to do this interview. It makes absolutely no sense. And he went on at some length, and I thought, certainly he's not coming. At the end, he said, but I agreed to come up, so I am coming. And at first, he agreed to no more than an hour, mm-hmm. and that was extended and then extended again. Ultimately, he came up on three separate occasions for 6 days of interviewing, over 20 hours in all.
I think it's just remarkable how you got him to do that. I want to understand more about the interchange between the two of you that you think kept him coming deeper and deeper into your realm. For listeners who haven't seen the film, and it's at this point it's out in New York and Los Angeles, I guess it's not in general distribution yet, but will be soon?
Yes.
Let's get just a little flavor of it here. Robert McNamara talks with Errol Morris about his truly amazing career. Whatever you think of it, it spanned an enormous number of jobs and wars and high tension, high death count American situations. Here's a clip where Robert McNamara is talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962 and explaining with some very audible passion how he believes the United States and Soviet Union, the world for that matter, escaped nuclear war in that standoff by mere luck.
I want to say, and this is very important, at the end, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. We came that close to nuclear war at the end. Rational individuals. Kennedy was rational. Khrushchev was rational. Castro was rational. Rational individuals came that close to total destruction of their societies. And that danger exists today.
Robert McNamara, 85 years old, speaking with Errol Morris. How did you take Robert McNamara to the point where, and we'll hear more, but where he was pouring out his guts in this way, where he was so forthright, staring straight into the camera and clearly working hard to deliver the nub of what he had taken away from the Cuban Missile Crisis? How did you bring him to that point, Errol Morris?
Willingness to listen. I don't think that there's any secret. I always believe that people, now I can't speak about what you're doing here, but people who come to an interview with a fixed agenda, if I see a list of questions, because God knows I've been interviewed many, many times, mm-hmm. if I see a list of questions, I think this is going to be a bad interview. I try to go into an interview not knowing what to expect, not knowing what questions to ask. Doesn't mean I don't prepare, but it's not the adversarial school. It's not the Mike Wallace school mm-hmm. of interviewing. I would call it the shut up and listen school of interviewing.
And you've got a technique, as I understand it, just in the placement of yourself and the subject that you're speaking with, you use something, and I don't know really what this is, but the interitron. What is that?
Well, I've been using it for years. Suddenly, people have become fascinated with this device. It's something so simple, it surprises me that other people don't use it. But it's a way of creating what I call the first person. Normally, when you see an interview filmed, the camera's off to the side. The camera is like a third person.
That's right. And the subject is speaking to someone unseen.
Or seen.
Or seen, but often just tangential to the camera.
That's correct. All eye contact is lost when the subject looks at the interviewer or vice versa.
That is, eye contact between the subject and the audience, ultimately, or the camera's eye.
Subject and the audience, subject and the interviewer, both lost. With this device, and I could go on at greater length about how it works, I don't think it's necessary.
But what was Robert McNamara looking at when he appears as the viewer of this film to be looking straight into my eyes? What's he actually seeing? His eyes are completely engaged here. Is he seeing a camera lens? Is he seeing your face? Is he seeing your face in real time responding to him?
He's seeing my face on a half-silvered mirror in real time responding to him, and the same is true of me. I'm looking at his face on a half-silvered mirror in real time responding to me.
So then in some sense, is it your, in addition to your questions, is it your face, your facial expression, your eyes that are pulling the emotion out of McNamara, that are almost hypnotizing your subject to a kind of candor that we don't normally expect?
No, I don't think it's hypnotism. What are interviews anyway? They're human relationships in a somewhat constrained setting.
Mm-hmm.
All I can say is that Robert McNamara fascinated me and continues to fascinate me, having finished this film and put it into distribution. There's something intensely interesting and mysterious about this story.
A story that the whole country was and remains caught up in so many dimensions. I found it absolutely compelling, much more so than I expected, though in your hands I expected something special. But I mean, McNamara really brings it right out there to the fore. We're talking tonight with documentary filmmaker Errol Morris. His new film is The Fog of War. Errol Morris, let me invite someone into our conversation right here, if I may. We're joined
sure.
on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts, by Samantha Power. She's Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Good evening and welcome, Samantha Power.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Samantha, you've written, paid attention to, and written recently about Robert McNamara, and I'm sure that you've seen and perhaps seen again Errol Morris's new film. What do you make of the way Robert McNamara spills his guts with this filmmaker? Isn't he crossing lines here that he never did before, and why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think Errol has put it best. Errol began a conversation with Robert McNamara that I think continues to this day off camera, and Robert McNamara has a lot to say. I mean, he is a person who's 87 years old. He has 60 years of public service behind him. He was a participant in World War II, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, obviously in the Vietnam War. He was also head of the World Bank.
Mm-hmm.
This is a man with opinions.
President of Ford Motor Company, briefly.
This is a man with opinions, with prescriptions, in his own mind, with lessons, and I think he's running out of time to impart them. And he's also watching, I think, foreign policy unfold in a fashion that he finds very troublesome, nuclear weapons proliferating, unilateralism, you know, wars, quite similar to those, I suppose, that he himself now has learned something about his own role in perpetuating or in orchestrating. So I think it's a combination of an extraordinarily gifted listener and filmmaker, if I may say, and a very, very eager policy-oriented veteran of a whole series of foreign policy crises,
Samantha,
that have bearing for today.
Samantha, Errol Morris frames it as 11 lessons from McNamara. What lessons did you take away?
Well, I think for one lesson is actually about how to talk to people who are seen to be morally tainted. And so it's a meta lesson. It's not even a lesson about the world that we live in today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that I think what Errol does that is done so rarely, either in, you know, reporting or in literature or in, you know, just about any medium that we have with us, is to actually try to understand deeds that carry evil consequences and to not believe that the effort to understand them is the same as an effort to justify them. So in other words, rather than sort of saying, well, Robert McNamara, you have 3 million Vietnamese on your hands, you have 58,000 Americans, to actually go back and say, how is it that incrementally well-meaning, liberal in the traditional sense of the word, you know, God-fearing, freedom-loving Americans can embark upon policies that lead to such deleterious results? And so I think a crucial lesson is that we need to see more of that so as to be able to understand how not to make the same mistakes again.
The way to listen and really hear, and Errol Morris pulls it out dramatically. Samantha Power, thanks for being with us tonight.
I should add that Samantha Power, in her own work, has tried to do very much the same.
Yes, she has. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with documentary filmmaker Errol Morris. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with groundbreaking documentary filmmaker Errol Morris, creator of the new film The Fog of War, plumbing the soul of Vietnam War architect Robert McNamara, and 10 other documentary films that, each one in its own way, just really crack open a person, a situation, in a way that's quite extraordinary. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you an Errol Morris fan? Has he made your screen? Has he challenged your view of the world, of your fellow Americans? Which film clicked into you into Errol Morris? Gates of Heaven, A Brief History of Time with Stephen Hawking, Thin Blue Line. Maybe you've managed to see the new one already, The Fog of War. And can you love the stately work of Ken Burns and the fringy kind of psychodrama probing of Errol Morris at the same time? Why not? But tell us how you see it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's at 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear more of the voice of Robert McNamara as captured by Errol Morris. Here he's talking about his time in World War II when he worked with then Colonel Curtis LeMay, later known as Bombs Away LeMay, whose unit was firebombing Japanese cities and later dropped the atomic bombs. LeMay played a role in JFK's administration, later as a hawkish general, but McNamara was an Air Force intelligence officer in World War II. And here he's talking about a situation after B-29 bombers had firebombed Tokyo during an air raid. You'll hear Morris asking him follow-up questions about his role in the decision-making of that devastating raid.
He was the only person that I knew in the senior command of the Air Force who focused solely on the loss of his crews per unit of target destruction. I was on the island of Guam in his command in March of 1945. In that single night, we burned to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo, men, women, and children.
Were you aware this was going to happen?
Well, I was part of a mechanism that in a sense recommended it. I analyzed bombing operations and how to make them more efficient. I.e., not more efficient in the sense of killing more, but more efficient in weakening the adversary. I wrote one report analyzing the efficiency of the B-29 operations. The B-29 could get above the fighter aircraft and above the air defense, so the loss rate would be much less. The problem was the accuracy was also much less.
Robert McNamara speaking with Errol Morris in the new documentary, The Fog of War. Robert McNamara, Errol Morris, famous for his statistical analysis of everything under the sun. But I was fascinated here, as emotional as he becomes, a confessional or advisory, I'm not sure how you saw it. But at the same time, there's still that...
Well, I think it's complex.
Definitely complex, and probably both. But that veneer of kind of classic McNamara that comes in when you ask him, did you know that 100,000 Japanese were going to die? And he responds, well, I was part of a mechanism that, in a sense, recommended it. That mechanism piece comes in. As an interviewer, is that a moment at which you're thinking he's still putting the mechanism between himself and what happened on that night?
Well, there are a lot of things going on here. One thing that fascinates me, it's very easy to look at evil and say, well, that's very bad, and the people responsible are very bad. Much harder to try to examine evil. I am endlessly fascinated with what is going on inside of people's heads? What are they thinking? What were they thinking? Remember, World War II for us was a just war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a war that we had to fight, and it was a war that we won. And McNamara is telling us a story about how unjust things can happen even in a just war.
Certainly very, very deadly things.
1945, one of the years that he speaks in detail about, seems to be such a crucial year for all of us. it's not simply the year that we dropped the two atomic weapons on Japan. It's also the year when clearly civilians became the target of war.
To break the will, to break the spirit of the Japanese.
Yes.
You know, I lived in Tokyo for quite a while in areas that were, spent a lot of time in areas that were completely destroyed on those nights. And you speak about the complexity of it. I mean, the way in which Japanese, 25, 30 years later, simply lived there on that very ground, as Germans have, as people have, I guess, throughout millennia. You know, the grounds of dying in war become the grounds of living later, yet it's not forgotten, yet it is forgotten day to day. Same way McNamara is dealing with the complexity of having ordered it, clearly feeling some agony about it as he relates it to you, and yet understanding it as part of his responsibility.
Yes.
How did you find him as a subject? You've had subjects from, you know, all corners, killers, wrongly accused killers, and pet cemetery founders, and some quite eminent people, Stephen Hawking. But this is obviously the most prominent subject of your major films. Did that change the interaction between you and your subject, Robert McNamara? Did it make it different in some qualitative way or not?
No, not really. It became somewhat easier to illustrate. I kept telling myself, well, there are a lot of images here. After all, he is telling the story of the 20th century, and cameras were present.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, this is also a Horatio Alger story.
His parents didn't go to high school. He was up by the bootstraps, guy to Harvard and presidency of Ford Motor Company and all the rest.
A man who essentially invented himself. And a man who believed first and foremost in rationality, that there were rational solutions to political, economic, and social problems. And of course, at the end of the movie, he wonders whether rationality is enough.
It seems to be more than that. He concludes that it is not. A kind of earth-splitting observation for Robert McNamara.
It may not be. The history of the 20th century, as told by Robert McNamara, is a story filled with errors, mistakes, confusions, wishful thinking, self-deception, denial, false ideology, you name it.
Kailash is calling from Cambridge,
and
Massachusetts.
And here's some even worse news. It's still going on, although the century has changed.
It is still going on. We've been talking about evil just tonight with Richard Pearl and David Frum, and I'm not sure what their conversation with Robert McNamara would sound like. Let's turn to a caller, Errol Morse. Kailash is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Kailash. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Repeat caller, love your show.
Thanks very
much. Fantastic show tonight. I've seen most of the films of the person that you're talking to, and I respect his work greatly. In particular, with respect to Mr. McNamara, I think McNamara is self-made, yes, certainly, but I think a lot of what has happened that is illustrated in the discussion we've had so far, particularly leading up to the Vietnam War, was almost inevitable, given the kind of person McNamara had invented himself to be. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that this particular film was made is great because hopefully, members of this current administration will take note and see this and see how their actions will be judged by history a few decades from now.
And well, the big question is, how do we get them to look at it?
Are they screening this in the White House cinema, Errol Morris?
Not so far as I know.
Well, I think a public discourse like this is perhaps the first step in getting someone like Mr. Rumsfeld to pay attention to what's actually going on.
Kailash, you say you've seen The Fog of War.
I've seen recently, I was just part of a particular group of the United States Cultural Center in Britain when this particular film was aired as part of a discussion on what's going on with respect to current events, and that was a few weeks ago.
There were some creepy moments there where McNamara's famous kind of wire-rim glasses and Rumsfeld's began to do a visual merge in my mind, and I wasn't sure who was behind that reflecting glass.
Indeed.
Kailash, thanks very much for your call. Owen's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Owen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've spoken to you once before in the past. I'm a psychiatrist here in Boston, Owen Sermon, and I just finished reading Wilson's Ghost, and I was very
McNamara's
impressed
latest
by,
book, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yes, and I was very impressed by your discussion and question about the interviewing process that Mr. Morris embarked on, and about Samantha Power's comment, which really, I think, is an echo of what McNamara talks about. He mentions over and over the word empathy. And in his argument in Wilson's Ghost, he's pleading for multilateralism as opposed to unilateralism. And what he's saying is that it's extraordinarily important to understand the other, or the enemy, if you will. And the understanding involves getting into that enemy's shoes in an empathic way. And, of course, McNamara failed at that terribly, and he understands that in Vietnam. He didn't understand that Nguyen Giap, for example, was going to take a couple of million losses.
And he says that very clearly. Errol Morris has got him conceding that right up front.
Exactly. Exactly. So the interview is so powerful because Mr. Morris is, in fact, giving McNamara what he perhaps himself wants, which is a measure of empathy, because also in Wilson's Ghost, he says that in 1969, he came forward and said it was time to get out of there, it couldn't be won, and that, it's before 69. He says that
in 1967.
Yeah, 67.
It's what really led to the end of his tenure as Secretary of Defense in the Johnson administration.
But let me jump off of what Owen's just given us. And Owen, thank you very much for your call. Here, it's lesson number one in your 11 lessons that McNamara lays out. Empathize with the enemy, or your enemy, I guess. I don't remember the exact word, but something to that effect. And he doesn't mean necessarily that you have to sympathize or share their cause, but at least understand them, or you may not have any idea what's going on in the conflict. But was McNamara himself, I mean, he failed in that with Vietnam, and he concedes that. What about in his relationships with the rest of the government around him, with the American people? I mean, was he an empathetic character, actor, I should say, when he was in power? Can you tell from your interview these years on, Errol Morris?
Well, remember, even though there's only ostensibly one character in The Fog of War, Robert McNamara, in some real sense, there are two characters. And at times you feel the 80-something-year-old McNamara is talking to the 40-year-old McNamara.
Railing back across the years. Why couldn't you? Why didn't you?
Of course, same person, but in some respects, a very different person.
Elmore, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Fort Worth, Texas, Michael Renoff. He's professor in the School of Cinema Television at the University of Southern California. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Subject of Documentary. Michael Renoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
I wish you'd help us understand Errol Morris in the kind of universe of American documentary filmmakers.
I hope you can help me to understand myself.
Well, there you are. You have an open subject in Errol Morris here. How would you place him, Michael Renoff?
Well, I would say that given that we're talking about a body of work that's now stretched over 25 years, mm-hmm. We're not talking about a newcomer. But we're certainly talking about someone who has helped to change the face of documentary filmmaking, I think probably not only in the U.S., but worldwide.
And what are the elements of the changes that Errol Morris has brought?
Well, I would say there are several of them. And if you'll permit me to be a little historical here.
Please.
If you go back a couple of decades, really to the period of Robert McNamara's ascendancy, which is the 1960s, the style of documentary filmmaking in the U.S. was very much what was called direct cinema, which meant that there was a kind of pretense of invisibility on the part of the filmmaker, mm-hmm. and that events would unfold. If people were going to present themselves to the camera, they would do it with the understanding or with a semblance of a kind of neutrality on the part of the filmmaker. Mm-hmm. If there is a crisis that unfolds, fine. But the filmmaker would never prompt, would never ask a question, would never ask for a second thought. Moreover, there was a kind of, and there, I think this is something that's been with us for many decades, a kind of sense of documentary realism, the way a documentary ought to look. It ought to feel as though it's the kitchen sink. It should look as though it's unstaged. It's the notion of mise-en-scène or any kind of staging is really not something that documentaries had much to do with.
The kind of invisible camera without footprints is the theater that's supposed
correct,
to be
correct, the kind of the invisible fourth wall that's mm-hmm. very close to what, let's say, Hollywood cinema has mm-hmm. has employed. Mm-hmm. With the work of Errol Morris, you see a much greater interest in, a challenging of that of those codes of documentary realism. You've mentioned it earlier in the program, something like an embrace of the reenactment, but by which I mean that under the direct cinema code, you can't do it again. You're either there to catch it the first time live and unprompted, or
it's not part of the film,
or it's simply not there. Mm-hmm. But if I may say, if you go back to the 1930s, which was another great heyday of documentary filmmaking, and especially in Britain, the name John Grierson here is a central one. There was a tradition of dramatic reenactment. Even Robert Flaherty's films like Nanook of the North. So reenactment is not something new, but we've forgotten because of the 1960s and of direct cinema that reenactment is a way to restage events that sometimes shows you them in a new light.
Now, Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line has the famous reenactment shown again and again of the killing of a policeman by a figure in a dark car. Is that controversial today, Michael Renoff, or is that now seen as just a part of the palette of the documentary filmmaker?
Well, I think that there's always controversy in documentary film around this question of reenactment or restaging. But I think that it's a kind of poison pill that Errol Morris's work has really helped, I think, the American public to swallow, and I think for the better, because the word that Mr. Morris used earlier, which was the word complexity, is, I think, maybe one of his great contributions to this public idea about documentary, because he rarely in his film seems to be saying, this is the truth, this is exactly what happened, this is what you ought to believe.
And yet...
Well, wait one second here.
Errol Morris.
When The Thin Blue Line came out and there were these reenactments... certain people were upset. How dare you put this kind of thing in a documentary film? Someone even accused me of trying to commit a fraud, convince people that I'd actually been at the crime scene with a camera.
Errol Morris, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break. We want to get the rest of it. Listeners, you can join us tonight. We're with documentary filmmaker Errol Morris. Can you hear how Errol Morris got Bob McNamara to spill his guts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Michael Renoff, stay with us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with groundbreaking documentary filmmaker Errol Morris, creator of the new film, The Fog of War, plumbing the soul of Vietnam War architect Robert McNamara. We're also joined tonight by Michael Renoff, a professor in the School of Cinema Television at the University of Southern California. You can join our conversation as well tonight. How much creative leeway do you want to give a film documentarian to get at the truth? And is human personality the greatest mystery, ultimately, of all? Does anybody plumb it better than Errol Morris? We were talking just before the break about Thin Blue Line, a 1988 film by Errol Morris. If you haven't seen it, it's about a Thanksgiving weekend, 1976. A Dallas County police officer, Robert Wood, was killed after pulling over a car. A month later, police arrested Randall Adams, a drifter, although 16-year-old David Harris was bragging to his friends about offing a cop. Adams was convicted, spent 12 years in prison. He was released after this film was made. It looks for all the world like because this film was made. Let's just get a little flavor of that, if we could, Errol Morris, before we hear your further thoughts on reenactment. Hear from Thin Blue Line.
Vidor is headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan for the state of Texas. And furthermore, the people of Vidor were under the impression that the policeman that was murdered was a black man. I had to stop at a motel on the way. At about 6 o'clock in the morning, Edith James, the lady lawyer, got up and was looking for me, and while she went out in the parking lot to find me, she went to one room, and someone in the parking lot said, if you're looking for the lawyer from Dallas, and he's in room, and she gave her the room number. Well, I immediately began to suspect from the time I was that close to Vider that I was being followed and observed. Doug Mulder had been there the week before I had and had told the people in Vider that I was a Eastern-educated civil liberties attorney and that I was down there to discredit David Harris.
And I should have said, this was the voice of defense attorney Dennis White talking about his first trip to Vider, Texas, the home of David Harris. Errol Morse, you took us so deeply into that Texas world. But on the subject of reenactment, how did you think about it then? What's the role? What's the freedom to reenact? What's the importance in your films?
Well, I wanted to thank Michael Renoff for saying that these reenactments have, in balance, not had a pernicious effect. Thank you. I would distinguish between reenactments that try to deceive, that try to show you the way the world really is, versus reenactments that take you deeper into the mystery of what happened. In The Thin Blue Line, these reenactments were mutually contradictory. They were illustrations of what people thought they saw or claimed they saw or wanted to see, but not what really happened. And at the heart of The Thin Blue Line is a search for truth, a search for what really happened, a search for who was responsible, a search for who pulled the trigger and killed the Dallas police officer.
But let me ask you about exactly that then. You just made an interesting distinction. You said reenactment is wrong if it attempts to deceive, which you then defined as trying to show what really happened, as if that is in itself implicitly deception, trying to show what really happened, because then you say you're trying to get at the truth.
Trying to claim, as someone thought I was trying to claim, I had been at the crime scene with a camera and had photographed it. The reenactments try to do nothing of the sort. They try to bring you deeper into the mystery of what happened on that roadway that night. But I should add, people have been fascinated by reenactments for long before even photography. And I like to point out to people, after all, everything might be a reenactment. Isn't consciousness a reenactment of the world in the mind?
We take it in and we make what we will of it. Michael Renoff, let me just ask you about this relationship between journalism and documentary filmmaking. What's the overlap? Are they the same? Are they different? Is documentary filmmaking supposed to do something that journalism does not, cannot?
Well, it's important to be clear on this connection between journalism and documentary filmmaking, that it has a historical character, it has a national and a regional character. That is to say, what I would say about the U.S. would be very different from, say, Britain or Australia or another part of the world.
I mean, because of American expectations or traditions, why?
Well, as I said, the direct cinema people of the 60s, that was very much a U.S. movement. And those people were really Robert Drew associates. That he came right out of journalism. And so there is a lot of overlap historically, but there are other traditions that embrace more connection to art making, to experimental film, et cetera. And other traditions that have more to do with even autobiography, for example, personal filmmaking. But if I could say, I think that what Errol Morris has been saying about his interest in kind of probing the depths and using reenactment as a way to take a second look and to entertain possibility, I think one of the reasons why A Thin Blue Line has been so influential, and it has been. If I've read one student paper on The Thin Blue Line, I've read 50. And I think it has partly to do with this unhinging of certainty around, well, this is what happened, and this is what things mean. And college students have been intrigued for 15 years with this film, because it really kind of has had an unsettling effect upon many viewers, because it kind of pulls the rug out from under you. If we can't trust jurisprudence, if we can't trust the legal structures, maybe things that we think we know are not quite so certain. And I think it's been a salutary effect, because if it gets people to think again and think closely.
Thank you very much.
The unhinging of certainty, it's a great phrase. Michael Renoff, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Michael Renoff, professor at the University of Southern California, author of the forthcoming book, The Subject of Documentary. Errol Morris, you're quoted in Salon magazine a couple of years ago as saying of Ken Burns, "I'd like to grind an axe against his head." Ken Burns, of course, a big, well-known mainstream American documentary maker. What's the sentiment that you're sharing there exactly? What's that mean?
Did I really say that?
Well, hey, we're talking about the truth here tonight, and I don't know what's true, but it's written down here in black and white, and the journalist sounds like he was paying attention. It may have been a moment of bad piece of beef.
I should add that journalist made up huge sections of that article, including the fact that he met with me when the interview was conducted on the telephone.
Let us leave that's an incredible piece of fiction, because he places you in a New York deli quite explicitly. But what about Ken Burns, Errol Morris? Is this just a different thread of documentary making? Is it anathema to you? Why?
Michael Renoff correctly pointed out that documentary isn't one thing. It's many, many different things. There are diary films. There's cinema verite. There are historical documentaries narrated with images. There's what I do, whatever that is. Am I partisan in some way to my way of making films? I have to confess, yes, I am.
Is there something that's missed in the others?
It's interesting that Michael Renoff talked about a tradition that came out of journalism. I was not trained as a journalist. I was trained as a historian. But I strongly feel the pull of truth, of what's out there, of curiosity about what happened, about the motivations of people, that has inspired almost every film that I've made.
Well, you've taken it to us again and again. This latest one is really something terrific, something important. The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, the latest documentary film by Errol Morris. Errol Morris, it's been just terrific having you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
Listeners, you can learn more about Errol Morris's career and films at our website. Go to onepointradio.org. In a moment, celebrating Elvis Presley's 69th birthday. This is On Point. Sixty-nine years ago this week, in Tupelo, Mississippi, Elvis Presley was born. Elvis's birthday was always a big day for Maryland resident Judith Minkow's mother, Jeanette. As the next-door neighbor of Elvis when he was a teenager, Judith's mother would be hounded every January 8th by reporters looking for stories of the king's youth. Judith's mother died this past year. In this radio diary, Judith Minkow share some of her mother's memories of a young Elvis Presley.
She was a reporter's dream, a guaranteed great story. Her compelling tales about Elvis riveted listeners. But they weren't merely tales. They were powerful anecdotes about a young man's character. And my mother, Jeanette Fruchter, was determined to set the record straight, especially on the anniversary of Elvis's birth. She simply couldn't bear to hear the stories about the aging Elvis's excesses. Repeatedly, she would tell reporters, he was the finest boy you'd ever want to know. But this will be the first year she won't be interviewed about Elvis. My mom died August 28, 2003. As we went through my mother's belongings, we stumbled on a photo that had not been published in any books. It shows Elvis at around 18 years old on the porch of our home with my sister Debbie, my brother David, and Elvis's cousin or friend whose name we can't recall. In the early 1950s, my family shared a Memphis duplex with the Presleys at 462 Alabama Avenue. They rented the small apartment downstairs. We lived upstairs. My parents knew Elvis when he was a teenager, between ages 15 and 18. During those years, my newlywed parents were struggling to make ends meet as our family grew. The Presleys were even poorer than my family. My father was the Orthodox rabbi for a small congregation and later founded and became principal of the Memphis Hebrew Academy. During the day, my mother would share coffee with Gladys Presley. Mrs. Presley confessed her worries about her son. She wanted him to give up his singing career to become a doctor, my mother said, but I told her she shouldn't worry. One day he would make her proud, no matter what career he chose. Mom would remind Mrs. Presley that Elvis was such a good boy. He worked at Crown Gas after school, and every Friday would cash his paycheck and turn the money over to his mother. And whenever my mother would come home from the grocery store, Elvis would run out to help her with the packages and bring them upstairs for her. In our house, Elvis was known as the Shabbos Goy, the Gentile who would turn on lights for us Friday nights or Saturdays when Orthodox Jews are forbidden to light a fire, which in time evolved into not turning on lights. Despite numerous offers for compensation, Elvis refused to take any money for those services. He also accompanied his family to church every Sunday, dressed in his finest threads. Handsome young Elvis would frequently pull out his guitar and serenade girls on the porch swing. My mother told us he was always a clothes horse and had been setting aside money for a pair of onyx cufflinks he saw at a jewelry store. My mother surprised Elvis and bought them for him as a high school graduation gift. The warm friendship between the two families continued through early 1955 when we moved to California. A couple of years later, my parents saw a headline in the local paper, Elvis surrounded by thousands of girls. My father looked at my mother and asked, "Do you think it's the same Elvis?" Indeed it was. My father called George Klein, Elvis's agent, who had celebrated his bar mitzvah in my father's synagogue. Backstage on concert night, Elvis greeted my father with open arms and made a big fuss over him. My mother, unfortunately, couldn't get a babysitter that night, so she couldn't go. That would be the last time Elvis and a member of my family would see each other. Years later, we learned that Elvis made generous contributions to Memphis Jewish charities because he recalled a Jewish family that had helped his family when he was younger. My mother was convinced that Elvis turned to drugs because his mother died so young and the two had been extremely close. When my mom heard the news on that sad August day, she was inconsolable. She spoke not as a disillusioned fan, but as an old friend. He was one of the biggest mensches I've ever known.
Well, down in New Orleans at the Golden Goose, I grabbed a green-eyed dolly that was on the loose. While I did that musical, she said me too. I said, pretty baby, come on and let's do it.
Judith Minkoff is an assistant director of communications at the Johns Hopkins University. She lives in Baltimore, Maryland. Elvis Presley would have turned 69 years old yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
That he lost his sticks. The cornet player hit a note that's flat. The trombone hit him while the poor cat sat. Dixieland rock.